Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 581, Update on Japanese Fascism. This is being recorded on January 15th of the year 2007. Before I launch into the broadcast, let me emphatically encourage people to utilize the vast amount of information available on the Spitfire website, long article-length descriptions of the For the Record shows and other broadcasts, a blog sphere maintained by a very intelligent and enterprising listener back east, a whole mini-library of old anti-fascist books put on very compact PDF files by that same editor. Surprising listener, and a host of other materials as well. The entire For the Record series is being archived on Real Audio by WFMU, so please use the enormous Spitfire website, now, by the way, featuring miscellaneous archive show M42, Uncle Sam and Il Duce, American Support for Mussolini and the Mythology of the Corporate State, a very important archive show, is now available for download for free, so please take advantage of it. We are going to be revisiting the subject of nascent Japanese fascism, or really dormant Japanese fascism, or clandestine Japanese fascism, because indeed the same sort of situation obtained in the relationship between Japan and the American corporate elite as between Germany and the American corporate elite. In fact, the Japanese, German, and American corporate elites were part of an international cartel system, and instead of investing their profits in U.S. infrastructure, the robber barons, as they were known, invested the enormous capital generated by the American industrial boom of the Roaring Twenties in Japanese and German strategic heavy industry, which was then turned into war-making capacity, used to conquer Asia and Europe respectively, and then the Japanese and Germans respectively garnered all of the liquid wealth of Asia and Europe. And when the cartel system was put back into place at the end of World War II, and the Japanese and German fascists, minus a few of their more notorious members, were put right back in power, sans uniforms, in order to fight the Cold War, basically Japan and Germany wound up winning from an economic standpoint. And indeed, just as Germany was never truly denazified in terms of its institutions, its military, its intelligence services, and its giant corporations, not to say that Germans are Nazis by any stretch of the imagination, but the power structure was never denazified, and that is true to an even larger extent in Japan. Many of the books that we've dealt with in the past, Gold Warriors, the Yamato Dynasty, two landmark texts by the Seagraves, go into that. And we're going to revisit the subject of Japanese fascism, the Japanese fascism that has existed since the end of World War II, and which may be taking a more virulent turn. We're going to begin by reading from the Los Angeles Times of Monday, September 25th of 2006. This is an op-ed column by Michael Zeilenziger, a former Tokyo-based correspondent. He's the author of Shutting Out the Sun, How Japan Created Its Own Lost Generation. It's due out, actually it's probably out at this point. This column by Michael Zeilenziger is called Will the Rising Sun Rise Again? Sounds rather like my For the Record show's Return of the Rising Sun, done intermittently over a period of years, and this is an update on that. Zeilenziger's column in the LA Times of 9/25/06 reads as follows. Beneath the sheen of high-tech tranquility that characterizes modern conformist Japansters, an angry, alienated, and deeply pessimistic populace teetering on the edge of a nervous breakdown. So the ascendance of a hawkish new leader, Shinzo Abe, as the hand-picked successor to Prime Minister Junichiro Koizumi on Tuesday, raises fears that the nation's long-repressed well of virulent nationalism, buried just beneath the surface, could again rise up, emboldened by a Bush administration seeking a surrogate partner to contain China's ambitions in Asia. Japan is rapidly aging because its young women refuse to marry and bear children. They say raising kids in modern Japan is far too expensive and offers too little reward. Besides, compared to their mothers, the aspirations of educated women extend beyond child-rearing, even though most Japanese men still insist that their wives stay home. The nation's middle-class army of sarurimon, or white-collar workers, uniformed in their blue suits and white shirts, is committing suicide in record numbers. Three times as many as die in car accidents because the system of lifetime employment in which they started their careers is crumbling. More troubling still are the more than 1 million Japanese 20-somethings who cannot find work and are not involved in any educational or training programs. A high number of these adults, primarily men, are social isolates or hikikomori. They hide in their rooms for months or years at a time rather than try to fit into a society that demands mass conformity and uses quietly powerful repression to forge it. This Japan has yet to design the social architecture necessary to embrace the individualism and self-expression we in the West associate with the post-industrial era. Neither schizophrenic nor suffering from any other mental illness, the only refuge these hikikomori find from a society they cannot trust is the bedroom in their parents' apartments. They are the nails that stick up and refuse to be hammered down. Into this unhappy stew of unacknowledged social unrest enters Abe, 52, who replaces the maverick Kozumi after his more than 5.5 years at the helm of Japan's ruling Liberal Democratic Party, which has essentially run the nation since 1955. Recent headlines proclaiming Japan's robust return to economic vibrancy are premature. The economy grew only 0.2% in the last quarter, compared to nearly 3% in the U.S. The national fiscal debt is 170% of gross domestic product, and the nation is rapidly depopulating. Last year, there were 15,000 more deaths than births in Japan, a nation that does not welcome immigrants. Demographers predict that by 2020, 1 in 9 Japanese will be over the age of 80. Hobbled by the mountains of debt they accumulated after the collapse of the infamous bubble economy in 1989, Japanese corporations restored profits by laying off thousands of older workers and by not hiring younger ones. Little wonder that youth unemployment is at record highs, that more than 20% of working people in their 20s now earn less than 1.5 million yen a year, just under $13,000, or that nearly 32% of young workers are non-permanent, without job guarantees, annual raises, or other benefits. 15 years ago, the comparable figure was 10%. Again, it's 32% today. Abe, a well-known hawk, wants to rewrite the country's post-war constitution in order to empower Japan's military. He promises to visit Yasukuni Shrine, which venerates World War II criminals, a move that riles leaders in Beijing and Seoul because it represents the spiritual pillar of the nation's wartime past. Abe is the grandson of former Prime Minister Nobusuke Kishi, who ratified the U.S.-Japan security treaty that even today keeps American Marines on Okinawa. He wants to deepen the already strong defense bonds that link Tokyo and Washington. He envisions Japan as a, quote, country that can be proud of its history and culture, unquote, a nod to the virulent strains of nationalism still frighteningly potent within Japanese society. The Bush administration naturally sees Japan and Abe as Washington's closest ally in the Pacific, even though Tokyo's relations with its most important neighbors, China and South Korea, have never been more on edge. A U.S. that once worried about containing Japanese militarism now insists that Japan's self-defense forces participate in the rehabilitation of Iraq, putting boots on the ground, unquote, as U.S. officials put it, even though these acts violate the Constitution our occupation forces dictated to the Japanese. The White House and Pentagon would welcome a Japan that beefs up its defenses against a potential threat from North Korea and the surging power of China. Yet this narrow focus on projecting military power obscures some potentially more disturbing truths. Only a few steps outside the spotlight being trained on Abe are powerful political leaders such as Shintaro Ishihara, the governor of Metropolitan Tokyo. He wrote the book The Japan That Can Say No, which controversially advocated that Japan strongly reassert its own national and military independence. Former Japanese Prime Minister Yasuhiro Nakasone has recently advocated that his nation needs to study the option of going nuclear, unquote, and no one doubts that Tokyo has lots of plutonium from its nuclear power plants and the technology to build bombs. At times of economic and social strain, when millions of young men wonder how they will find work and what their nation will become, virulent forms of nationalism have a way of binding up deeper wounds. Witness the protests against Japan and China. Many Japanese recognize that their nation, so suffocatingly embraced by Washington since the end of World War II, has yet to determine its identity and national interests. Is it so far-fetched to imagine a day when a rearmed, angry, and nuclear-potent Japan cuts its ties with Washington in order to reassert a more independent foreign policy? Would that make Pacific Asia a more tranquil or a more dangerous place? Japan needs to decouple its future from the United States, resolve the challenges of its history, and move vigorously to create a new and more integrated relationship with its long-term economic partners, especially China. The leaders of Japan's multinational businesses already well understand this, and they may yet help transform the practical vision of their new prime minister. If they do not succeed, however, Abe's ascension may ultimately trigger the kind of arms race and brinksmanship that would destabilize all of Asia. In that sense, he could be the wrong man at the wrong time. Well, again, one of the things that Zeilenziger is pointing out there is that the Japanese people are very troubled psychosocially and economically, and as has so often been the case throughout history in so many cultures, when there is domestic distress of an economic nature, it is very good. It is very useful, at least in the short term, to point to those people, whether it's African Americans in the U.S., Jews in just about any place, the outside Chinese in Southeast Asia, or whomever. It's very easy to point to those people, the other, and blame it on them and scapegoat them for problems. And obviously, Zeilenziger is expressing anxiety that basically a let-them-eat-fascism approach could wind up becoming a de facto policy in Japan. A couple of things. First of all, note the reference there to the Liberal Democratic Party and to Nobusuke Kishi, because Kishi was not only a Japanese war criminal, but he was the individual that was ascribed the M Fund. The M Fund was a multi-billion-dollar fund that was composed of Japanese war loot, which was then put at the disposal not only of key Japanese politicians, but also the international cartel system. The book Gold Warriors by Peggy and Sterling Seagrave goes into that. I've accessed that book in numerous broadcasts. The landmark Seagrave text is basically the same sort of text for the World War II in Asia as the Martin Bormann Nazi in Exile text is for World War II in Europe. It explains the economic, not the battlefield victory, but the economic victory of Japan and Germany. As one Japanese observer put it, talking about Japan, suppose a man robs a bank of $100 million. He then gets caught, is sentenced to 6 years in prison. He serves his sentence, but is allowed to keep the $100 million he stole. Can he be said to have gotten away with the crime? Well, in essence, that's what the Japanese and Germans did, and because they were cartel partners with elements of the American power elite, and the phenomenon of globalization really having begun long before most people became aware of it, the status quo, namely putting the cartel partners back in power and letting them keep their wealth, became, well, that was the way to go at the end of World War II. Now, of Nobusuke Kishi and his control of the M Fund, we read, reviewing from For the Record 451 and in turn from Gold Warriors by the Seagraves, in 1960, the M Fund was said to have an asset base worth 12.3 trillion yen, or $35 billion. It's important to note that then-Vice President Nixon did not turn the M Fund over to the government of Japan, but to Prime Minister Kishi personally, putting the lie to his grandiose justifications. So a few months later, when Kishi ceased to be Prime Minister, he and his clique continued to control the M Fund. It goes without saying that they never used it for the designated purpose, instead turning it into a private source of personal enrichment. The M Fund, again, billions upon billions of dollars worth of Japanese war loot used to control the political landscape of post-war Japan. Now, of Mr. Kishi, who is the great-grandfather of current Prime Minister Abe, ultimately his successor. Actually, he's the grandson, not the great-grandson. Speaking of the political history of Mr. Kishi, whose grandson Prime Minister Abe is, in 1956, for example, the Eisenhower, this, by the way, from Gold Warriors by the Seagraves, in 1956, for example, the Eisenhower administration labored long and hard to install Kishi as the head of the newly merged Liberal Democratic Party and as Japan's new prime minister. And here's Kishi's background. This was the same Kishi who had been a member of the hardcore ruling clique in Manchuria with General Tojo Hideki and Hoshino Naoki, head of the narcotics monopoly. In other words, basically, he not only was part of the Japanese power elite, the ruling clique in Manchuria, but also was very tight with Hoshino Naoki, the head of the Manchurian narcotics monopoly run by the Japanese. Continuing, Kishi had also signed Japan's Declaration of War Against America in December of 1941. During World War II, he was Vice Minister of Munitions and Minister of Commerce and Industry, actively involved in slave labor. Along the way, he made a personal fortune in side deals with the Zaibatsu. Those are the giant family trusts that were the Japanese part of the international cartel system, of which the German corporations and the giant corporate interests run by the robber barons in the U.S. were other key parts. Continuing. Following Japan's surrender, he, Kishi, was one of the most prominent indicted war criminals at Sagamu Prison, where he was a cellmate of Yoshio Kodama. In 1948, when his release from prison was purchased by Kodama, Kishi began organizing the financial base of the LDP using Kodama's black gold and injections of M-Fund cash. Yoshio Kodama, by the way, a key Japanese war criminal, also the CIA's man in Japan for many years, and also, by the way, not incidentally, a key official with the Unification Church, which appears to be a direct extension of the Japanese patriotic and ultranationalist societies that brought fascism to Japan in the first place. More about that later. Now, as part of Mr. Abe's new right-wing agenda, patriotism classes, unquote, are going to be taught to Japanese school children. This from the Washington Post of December 15th of 2006. This is an article by Anthony Fiola of the Washington Post, headlined, "Japan Passes Landmark Patriotism Laws," it reads in part. Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's government on Friday successfully pushed through landmark laws requiring Japanese schools to encourage patriotism in the classroom and elevating the Defense Agency to the status of a full ministry for the first time since World War II. Both measures are considered cornerstones of Abe's conservative agenda to bolster Japan's military status and rebuild national pride in a country that had long associated patriotism with its imperialist past. The legislation cleared the upper house of parliament on Friday after winning approval in the lower house last month and will come into effect early next year. Abe, Japan's first prime minister born after World War II, had made education reform a key issue during his campaign to succeed Junichiro Koizumi in September. His bid to restore patriotism in schools has drawn harsh criticism from Japanese pacifists, who have argued that such a law echoes the state-sponsored indoctrination of children practiced by Japan's past leaders. But Abe and other proponents have countered that a renewed embrace of patriotism is an essential step forward for Japan as it gradually emerges from a decades-long sense of guilt over World War II. In recent years, for instance, local municipalities have begun enforcing laws requiring the national anthem to be sung and the Japanese flag flown at certain school ceremonies, despite objections from teachers' unions, which remain one of the last bastions of pacifism in Japan. The education reform law is likely to dramatically increase the number of schools using revisionist textbooks that have been heralded by conservatives here, but decried by Japan's wartime victims, particularly China and South Korea, as whitewashing its past aggression. Such books, for instance, omit reference to comfort women, unquote, a euphemism for the thousands of Asian women forced into sexual bondage by the Japanese military during the 1930s and 1940s. While those books also gloss over things like the Rape of Nanking and others, it is fundamentally revisionist history. And by the way, to give people an idea of the sort of the type of propaganda that is routine on the Japanese right, and which in turn obviously is not only exculpatory of Japan's role in World War II, but basically seeks it in effect keeps alive the prevailing political mythology of Japan's fascist period. The following article is from the Financial Times of Friday, August 25th of 2006. This is a story by David Pilling, P-I-L-L-I-N-G, in Tokyo. It's headlined, "Japan to Remove Exhibit from War Museum." Yasukuni Shrine officials, this is the shrine which honors, among others, Japanese war criminals, and the visiting of which by Japanese prime ministers has been very controversial. Yasukuni Shrine officials have agreed to delete a controversial exhibit and discuss further changes to the shrine's military museum, criticized by many for glossing over Japan's wartime history. Officials from the shrine will meet a leading conservative historian today to discuss the alternations. These are likely to focus on exhibits that accuse the U.S. of deliberately forcing Japan into the Second World War, but are unlikely to address more contentious displays relating to the Japanese invasion of China and Southeast Asia. However, agreement to make changes would show that Yasukuni, which has become a flashpoint in Japan's relations with Asia, is sensitive to outside pressure, even though it is a private religious organization. The museum, which was renovated in 2002 to reflect what many consider a revisionist view of Japanese history, is adjacent to the shrine, which honors Japan's war dead, including a handful of convicted war criminals. Hatsuhiko Okazaki, a right-wing political commentator, said museum staff and an advisory historian from Japan's Self-Defense Force had agreed to meet him today to discuss potential changes. Check out what's in this museum. The meeting follows a column in yesterday's Sankei newspaper in which Mr. Okazaki called for the removal of an exhibit accusing Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the former U.S. president, of engineering a war with Japan to strengthen the U.S. economy. The exhibit says the plan to force Japan into war followed the failure of Roosevelt's New Deal. Mr. Okazaki said the shrine had agreed yesterday to delete that reference. Skipping down, Thomas Schieffer, the U.S. ambassador to Japan, has expressed dislike of the Yasukuni Museum, which he says presents a skewed and disturbing view of Japan as wartime victim. And indeed, that is a very interesting view of World War II, indeed, begun by Franklin Roosevelt. I mention this because this is now, once again, that revisionist history is once again on the march, and not just in Japan, and not just among residual or yearning fascist elements in Japan. One is seeing a lot of that in the United States as well, in particular just as the Bush administration is moving to roll back the social programs of the New Deal, Social Security in particular. So too we're seeing a propaganda blitzkrieg aimed at undermining Franklin Delano Roosevelt's political legacy. In particular, predictably, some elements of the so-called 9/11 truth movement have embraced this, and frankly it's just drivel. Not only was Franklin Roosevelt not a warmonger, but he was sort of a lone wolf standing against the industrialists and financiers, the robber barons, the same people who tried to overthrow Roosevelt in 1934, the same ones who helped to capitalize Hitler and Nazi industry. They functioned in a similar fashion in Japan, and just as they saw Germany as not only a good investment climate but a bulwark against communism in Europe, they saw Japan as a good investment partner and as a bulwark against communism in Asia. And for that reason, they were very much in favor of the Japanese War of Conquest, which they not only saw as instituting anti-communism on mainland Asia, but in particular, they favored it because they stood to profit ultimately by a successful Japanese war of aggression. They were business partners with the Japanese zaibatsu. Roosevelt, in turn, was standing against that and was the only one who wanted to basically cut off American economic aid to Japan because it was being used, oil in particular, as well as scrap metal. It was being used to commit things like the rape of Nanking. So watch out for the, you know, Roosevelt push the poor Japanese into war kind of thing. It is just pure fascist drivel. And what this is all about is the rap is that Roosevelt deliberately allowed Pearl Harbor to go forward. In fact, the entire Pacific theater was on a war footing from late November of 1941 on. At some point, maybe I'll do a program about Pearl Harbor, but watch out. That sort of historical revisionism is on the march, and indeed, the house historian for Bertelsmann, which now dominates English language publishing and is also, not incidentally, the publishing house of the SS in World War II, the house historian of Bertelsmann, Dirk Bovendam, has published a series of books, the last in 1998, again, the same thing, blaming World War II on Franklin Delano Roosevelt, Jewish control of the American media, and Hollywood. Interesting view of World War II. Now, one of the things that's taken place since I was last on the air is the testing of a nuclear weapon, of an atomic bomb, by North Korea. That has boosted Abe's agenda in Japan. The New York Times of Tuesday, October 10th of 2006 discussed this. Article by Martin Fackler, it's headlined, "Japan now seems likely to rally behind new prime minister's call for a stronger military." The last time North Korea tested a powerful new weapon in 1998 when it fired a ballistic missile over the largest Japanese island, Japan reacted by upgrading its military and swinging politically to the right. North Korea's claim that it tested a nuclear weapon on Monday appears likely to push Japan even farther down the same nationalist path. Many political analysts say the test, which has yet to be confirmed, could weaken public support for the pacifism Japan adopted after World War II and prompt it to seek a growing regional security role. Well, it remains to be seen if, in fact, that happens. One of the things that's interesting to me, and we're going to conclude this broadcast, as we often do, on a speculative note, that is the fact that it appears that at least some of the capital that went to generate the North Korean nuclear program came from economic aid given to North Korea by the Unification Church of Reverend Sun Myung-moon. Nominally South Korean, the core of the Unification Church has always been Japanese, and many of the key early figures in the Unification Church were Japanese war criminals, including the aforementioned Yoshio Kadama, the cellmate of Nobusuke Kishi in Sagamo Prison, and the fellow who helped to bail Kishi out. One of the interesting things is that, as I discussed in For the Record program number 291, called From Kennebunkport to Pearl Harbor, Bush, Moon, and the Rising Sun, there are very firm indications that although nominally South Korean, in fact, the Unification Church is a direct extension through the decades and around the world of the Japanese patriotic and ultranationalist societies that brought fascism to Japan in the first place. Good discussion of that in 291. And so we're going to conclude by touching on an article by Robert Perry of the Consortium News website. This is from this was originally published on October 11th of 2000. It's called Moon, North Korea, and the Bushes. The Reverend Sun Myung-moon's business empire, which includes the right-wing Washington Times, paid millions of dollars to North Korea's communist leaders in the early 1990s when the hardline government needed foreign currency to finance its weapons program, according to U.S. Defense Intelligence Agency documents. The payments included a $3 million birthday present, unquote, to current communist leader Kim Jong-il, and offshore payments amounting to several tens of millions of dollars, unquote, to the previous communist dictator Kim Il-sung, the documents said. Moon apparently was seeking a business foothold in North Korea, but the transactions also raised potential legal questions for Moon, who appears to have defied U.S. embargoes on trade and financial relations with the Pyongyang government. So he certainly, Moon that is, was certainly getting boots on the ground, so to speak, for his organization in North Korea, certainly expanding their business possibilities, business operations, by the way, that include effective control over the sushi business in the United States. What is interesting to contemplate is it possible that the Moon Organization also understood that some of this money might be used for weapons development and that ultimately a nuclear-capable or militarily aggressive North Korea would be a wonderful pretext for rolling back pacifism and breaks on Japanese nationalism and fascism. And as the Japanese people again face the social anxiety of an uncertain and changing economy, is it possible that Mr. Abe, as have so many leaders throughout the centuries, will basically say, let him eat fascism or let him eat war or let him eat bigotry? It's a common response. Will that happen in Japan? We'll see. Please utilize the Spitfire website. Many of the topics that I've touched on here are referential. If you want to understand Japanese fascism, want to understand the Moon Organization, want to understand Operation Golden Lily, the cartel system, the other things I've spoken about, www.spitfirelist.com. It is also a page to click on to contribute to the work that I'm doing. This concludes For the Record program number 581, Update on Japanese Fascism. This has been recorded on January 15th of the year 2007. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.